So those are two ministries in our local area that, and we've been particularly supporting New Hope Community Services a lot lately, and they said one of the main ways that we can help as a church is with community dinners, and we do these pretty regularly. We have the next one coming up in August. I didn't actually plan on talking about that, but so I think the date is August 8th, but it'll be in the bulletin later on as well. But I also wanted to take this opportunity just to say that we do have Tuesday night. We're going there to finish up a gardening project we started 2 weeks ago, and it was really awesome there. There was me and Dustin, really. besides just us, there were so many people from the building that came out and were just, like, so involved. Lots of kids were there. It was really fun just to, like, I mean, it was probably more hindering to our progress, having all these kids taking the important tools that you need, and they wouldn't want to give them to you when you need them. But it was just really awesome being able to make an impact on their entryway. The first thing that people see as they walk into this building is kind of the first impression. And so this is just an awesome way to help these guys out. And so I'd encourage you to come 6:30 to 8:30 Tuesday night. And we're just going to hopefully try to finish up the project. I think based on our progress last time, it might be a little close, but we could probably do it if we have enough people coming out. So we're finishing now our series in Daniel. This is the last sermon of this series, and we're going to be looking at chapter 6, which is the last chapter in the book that speaks of sort of the time, the story of Daniel and his friends in the midst of this royal palace, basically. So just as a quick recap of where we've come, I mean, we've really looked at, in these last six chapters or five chapters, we've just kind of picked out snippets of Daniel's life from when he was just a young boy to now when he's like in his 80s, basically. And so in chapter one, we saw Daniel as a young man and with these three other friends who get captured along with all of Israel, and Jerusalem is besieged. Nebuchadnezzar destroys this temple and they're taken captive as exiles to Babylon. And so Daniel and his three friends are brought into the royal temple, the royal palace, and they're brought into this assimilation process so that they can be useful and not problematic in this palace to the king. And so they're sort of trying to rid any Israelite identity, but God faithfully preserves Daniel and his friends, and he gives Daniel this special ability to interpret visions and dreams, which becomes really important later on in his time in the royal palace. And so then in the next chapter, we see this coming into play where Nebuchadnezzar has his dream and no one is able to interpret it or let alone tell him what the dream is. And so then Daniel comes and he interprets the dream. He tells the king what the dream is and he gives it the interpretation. And this earns Daniel a lot of status in the kingdom. He's known now more so than he was known before. But above that, we see God working on a grander scale to exemplify his ultimate sovereignty and control over history and over the great king of Babylon. And the king doesn't, though, acknowledge, like even after witnessing this, Nebuchadnezzar, the king doesn't acknowledge God as the Most High God. And so in the next chapter, we see him bringing up this big idol and commanding the whole city to worship this idol. And Daniel's not really found in this story in chapter 3, but we do see his three friends who refuse to worship this idol. And even after being given a second chance, they refuse, and Nebuchadnezzar throws them into the fiery furnace. But they are saved, and God's presence is with them in the midst of this furnace. And again, they come out unscathed, and Nebuchadnezzar sees this, and he's still kind of like, he sees that God is, this God is powerful, but he doesn't quite acknowledge him still as the Most High God, and he sees himself as possibly even a greater God still. And so then the next chapter, we see his pride consume him, which leads to God finally punishing him and reducing him to be in this beast-like state until he finally recognizes that God is the Most High God, that his kingdom is an eternal kingdom, and God restores him to his position and his power and his authority. And then he passes away, as far as we know. Chapter 5, it all of a sudden jumps a few generations ahead. And at this point now, Daniel's like late 70s, about 80 years old. And we saw last week how he is now relating to this new king, Belshazzar, who's a descendant of Nebuchadnezzar. And the writing ends up appearing on the wall as Belshazzar and his friends are partying and desecrating the sacred temple vessels. And the writing says, "Many, many tekel parson," which when Daniel comes and translates these words, it means that that the king's days are numbered, and that he has been weighed and found wanting, and his kingdom will be divided and will be given to the Medes and the Persians. And so we ended last week, the last phrase of chapter 5 was that very night Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain, and Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. And this is right where we pick it up in chapter 6, where Darius the Mede now is the ruler. And this is probably, arguably, the most popular story in Scripture that we're going to be going through today. This is the story of Daniel in the lion's den. And I mean, most people who have grown up in the church are kind of familiar with this story because of a couple talking vegetables. And you get those dumb songs that get stuck in your head for years, like, I am King Darius, I had a dream. Actually, now that I think about it, though, he never actually does have a dream. Darius, whatever. They got that wrong. And as I mentioned 2 weeks ago, this story of chapter 6 is, like I mentioned, actually the first six chapters have lots of parallels in them, and chapter 6 is very much a parallel to the story in chapter 3 with Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego in the fiery furnace. In a lot of ways, they're very similar. And when Dustin spoke on this chapter, he made the point that these guys were positive that God was able to deliver them from the fire, but even if God did not deliver them, they wanted the king to know that their allegiance to God would not change. And so the point of that story wasn't serve God and everything will go right for you. It's serve God and you won't face any harm. That's not the point. The point was that God alone is worthy of our service and worship, and the outcome of that is much less determined. And in fact, it's probably the cause of much hardship and persecution. And so I guess like part of the problem with our VeggieTales understanding of the story is it just kind of leaves us with this good note of, you know, we have nothing to fear because God's with us. He'll save us from all of our problems. And I think there's a little bit of a problem in that because that's not really the case of history in the Christian church. I mean, ironically, lots of Christians did die to the mouths of lions during the Roman period. And so I don't want us to kind of like take our, if we did grow up in the church, and I don't want us to take that sort of simplistic version of the story and just call it quits, like call it like we're done with the story. Now we know what it means. We don't need to focus on it anymore. I want us to kind of broaden our perspective a little bit and see this story in the midst of this book of these exiles in Babylon and what all it means. As we compare this to chapter 3, there's a lot of similarities, and you could say that I'm just preaching the same thing that Dustin preached, which I'm not going to do that, though, because there are differences, and the differences are what I want to focus on. And the main difference really could be seen in the way that Daniel's three friends, they presented faithfulness through refusing to worship an idol, whereas in this chapter in Daniel 6, Daniel exemplifies faithfulness through refusing to stop worshiping Yahweh. And so the difference is the object of the worship that's being addressed here. Like, are you going to worship an idol? No. And then in this chapter, are you going to stop worshiping God? No. And so this idea of persistent faith is more the topic for today. And in the language of this chapter, this tension is formed through this battle that is set up between the law of God versus the law of the Medes and the Persians. And so let's dive into this chapter. I'll have it on the screen, but if you're flipping to it, let me just quickly take this opportunity to remind us of the context. I've kind of already gone over chapter 1 to 5, but I just wanted us again to remember that Darius the Mede now is in power, and that's really important because he is of the Median Empire, which shortly became merged with the Persian Empire, so it's the Medes and the Persians. And this is really important because this marks the end of the Babylonian era. They're not the major force anymore. Now the Medes and the Persians have come to power, and there's a new major power figure on earth. And so Daniel finds himself in the midst of this transition, and this is where we find him in chapter 6. And so let's begin reading. So it pleased Darius to appoint 120 satraps to rule throughout the kingdom, with three administrators over them, one whom was Daniel. The satraps were made accountable to them so that the king might not suffer loss. Now Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. At this, the administrators and the satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel and in his conduct of government affairs, but they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. Finally, these men said, "We will never find any basis for charges against this man, Daniel, unless it has something to do with the law of his God." And if you remember last week, the reward that Belshazzar offered for the one who could translate that writing on the wall, the reward was to be given a third of the kingdom. And ironically, we see Daniel receiving this reward, even though Belshazzar has passed at this point. But even more than that, he's now being seen as a greater asset to the kingdom, and there's plans set in place to put him over the entire kingdom, which human nature then naturally took over these other administrators, and they grew jealous of Daniel and of his special treatment. And so they are seeking to find a way to incarcerate him. And there, as they search his life and his history, they can find no dirt in him. There's nothing they can find that would make him guilty. And so they try to manufacture guilt just by attributing his unswerving allegiance to God. And I want to tell us a quick story of it's a story I read just a few weeks ago. Ellen and I have been reading through the Bible in a year, and I think it was like 2 months ago now, but this story came up in one of the devotional sections, and it stood out to me as I was preparing the sermon because it illustrates this point more. And so the story tells of a clerk that is hired at a department store. And one day this call comes into the store, and the clerk answers the phone, and the person on the other end of the line wants to speak to the owner. And so the clerk goes into his office and holds out the phone to him and says, "There's someone on the line for you." And the boss tells him, "Tell him I'm out." And so the clerk kind of stays there with his hand out and says, "You tell him you're out." And so this owner just is furious with this new clerk, and so after he finally reluctantly takes the call, he confronts him about it. And the clerk responds to him by saying, "If I can lie for you, I can lie to you." And so from this point on, the owner had an enormous amount of respect for this clerk and knew that he could trust him deeply. And I tell this story since it highlights the importance of having a mindfulness of everything we do. Even a little white lie that could have planted a seed of distrust between the owner and the clerk. But by telling the truth, even though it went against the owner's request, he displayed his high value of honesty. That he wasn't willing to compromise honesty for the sake of appeasing his boss. And so in our lives, we face daily choices whether or not we're going to compromise our values or our beliefs in some areas of our lives, even if it doesn't appear to affect anybody else. But if we were to face the same kind of scrutiny that Daniel received, or for that matter, if we want to think in more of a modern context, the same kind of scrutiny that any political figure would face, would the private investigators come back and say that there is no dirt that can be found in this person? I mean, that's a pretty tough goal to live up to. You'd have to be very mindful of everything you do, and that's a really tough thing to do, right? But in order to understand how Daniel's life could be so free from the scrutiny of these men, the key is to see that Daniel never stopped worshiping Yahweh. That was his key. His faithfulness to stop worshiping God oriented his life around God and served as a constant reminder of his dependence on God, of the fact of the reason why he's in an exile in the first place, and of the hope of deliverance from exile. And so this consistent worship of God is the point I want us to see today. It is that it's when we take our eyes off of God and we begin to find worth, value, satisfaction in other things, that's when all of our other problems begin to start. And so as we apply that to us, like reading the Bible and praying, these aren't things that should be seen as supplementary to our faith. These aren't checklist items that ought to be accomplished on a day-to-day basis, but they're foundational for our days, and they help us stay rooted in God so that we don't stray in our worship. We are naturally worshiping people. Like, that's how God created us. He created us to be worshipers, people who see something else and find value and honor and attribute worth to things. That's just naturally what we do. And oftentimes we tend to value, you know, our homes or our money or our jobs or our status. And these things become objects of worship that when we start attributing those as the sole object of our worship, we naturally then stray away from God, taking what rightfully is his place. And so Daniel was able to maintain this dirt-free life by maintaining a constant prayer life and focus on Yahweh as his source of dependence and worth and hope. And so let's keep reading here in verse 6. It says, "So these administrators and these satraps went as a group to the king and said, 'May King Darius live forever. The royal administrators, prefects, satraps, advisors, and governors have all agreed that the king should issue an edict and enforce the decree that anyone who prays to any god or human being during the next 30 days, except to you, your majesty, shall be thrown into the lion's den. Now, your majesty, issue the decree and put it in writing so that it cannot be altered, in accordance with the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed.' So King Darius put the decree in writing. Now, when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened toward Jerusalem. Three times a day he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God, just as he had done before." Now, the narrative indicates that this turning towards God on Daniel's part wasn't some like frantic thing that he's doing in desperation. It kind of lays it out as this like calm, collected, like he's just doing what he always does. And so a commentator named Tremper Longman comments on this when he says, "The impression the narrative intends to impart is Daniel's unflinching obedience. He does not question, doubt, or worry. He acts. He does not bow toward Darius, but toward Jerusalem. Darius is neither the object nor the mediator of his prayers. That role is taken by Yahweh. He does not question, doubt, or worry. He acts." I'll come back to that, but the question that needs to be addressed here is, why does he turn toward Jerusalem? And most scholars would agree that this action is motivated by a prayer that Solomon made, and we find that prayer in 2 Kings chapter 8, verse 35 to 36 in particular. But in this prayer, it's a prayer of dedication, because the temple had just been recently built, and so he's dedicating this temple to the Lord. And in this prayer he says, "When the heavens are shut up and there is no rain because your people have sinned against you, and when they pray toward this place, toward the temple, and confess your name and turn from their sin because you have afflicted them, then hear from heaven and forgive the sin of your servants, your people Israel. Teach them the right way to live and send rain on the land you gave your people for an inheritance." So this is Solomon praying at the dedication of this temple. He's recognizing that this is going to be a place not where God's presence is contained in some way, but it's going to be the place where God specifically chooses as the meeting place where people can come and worship God. And so this act of turning toward Jerusalem wasn't just like some random thing. That's the way his window opened, like he just happened to be turning that way and that's what the narrative says, but it's a symbolic act of turning towards God. And even though the temple that he's turning towards, like he's turning towards Jerusalem, and Jerusalem is where the temple was, so even though he's turning towards this temple, it's in ruins at this point. And so most likely his prayers were also contained a sense of longing and of hope for this future restoration of the temple. And these were regular prayers. Not just Daniel, but all the exiles were likely praying these prayers, longing for God to fulfill his promise of restoration. And in this way, these were also prayers that reoriented these exiles towards Yahweh. As I mentioned way back in chapter 1, this assimilation process they went through, like they needed to be rooted and grounded in recognizing Yahweh as their source of dependence. And that was such an important thing for their identity and for their livelihood, really. And so these prayers that Daniel offers were probably taking place all throughout his life up until this point, even though it just mentions it in this chapter. And so Daniel here is praying as he always does, despite this new law of the Medes and Persians to prohibit his prayers for the next 30 days. But he is persistent in prayer because he knows that without reorienting himself towards Yahweh, his worship is naturally going to shift elsewhere. And so let me hypothetically ask us today, if this law was instigated today, that you couldn't pray to anyone or anything except for Justin Trudeau for 30 days, or you'd be killed, like if that was a law that got put in place today, would your life be radically affected by it? Or would it be easy for us just to not pray for a month? And my fear is that many of us, and if not many of us, then many Christians in the world, would be in no way affected by this kind of a law. And I mean, in some ways, my fear is that many people are already living as if a law like this is in place. That prayer is infrequent and viewed as a supplementary part of our faith rather than foundational. And for Daniel, prayer was the key to faithfulness. It was the key to keeping a conviction and a culture of compromise. And as I drove to the office on Tuesday, it's a long drive now because I got to come from Abbotsford, but so I had lots of time to just do whatever. And as soon as I got on the road, I started getting convicted of my own lack of faithfulness in my prayers. And ironically, I hadn't really spent a lot of time on this sermon yet. Like, I had kind of got the general gist of it, but I'd planned on writing a good part of it on Tuesday. And as I started coming to this section, I started to realize why God all of a sudden exposed me of my unfaithfulness in prayer. It's so crucial to spend time with God to be reminded of the areas that we fall short, and to praise God for the blessings that he's given us, and to lift up our hopes and our desires and lay them before God, to receive forgiveness for our past mistakes and strength not to make those mistakes again, and to receive God's grace in order to extend that to other people. And I'd encourage you to see prayer as Daniel saw it, not as an accessory to our faith, but as a priority and a foundation. And so we do have a summer prayer guide, just, you know, a sponsorship here. It sounds funny, but yeah, I'd really encourage us all to take one of those on the way out. It'll be a way just to guide us every day throughout the summer until the end of August, just with various things we can pray about throughout the summer. And it's more meant to be a launching pad. Like, I mean, you can pray for that, but I would encourage you to, like, take that opportunity to pray about other things too. Because in Redemption Church, we believe that prayer is powerful and important, and we want to help cultivate an active prayer life in our church. And so let's keep reading. So these conspirators have coerced the king to make an irreversible decree stating that no prayers are to be offered to anyone or anything other than King Darius for 30 days. But Daniel, despite this law, continues his regular routine of praying to Yahweh. And so now we read, then these men went as a group and found Daniel praying and asking God for help. So they went to the king and spoke to him about his royal decree. Did you not publish a decree that during the next 30 days, anyone who prays to any god or human being except to you, your majesty, would be thrown into the lion's den? The king answered, the decree stands in accordance with the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed. Then they said to the king, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, your majesty, or to the decree you put in writing. He still prays three times a day. When the king heard this, he was greatly distressed. He was determined to rescue Daniel and made every effort until sundown to save him. Then the men went as a group to King Darius and said to him, remember, your majesty, that according to the law of the Medes and Persians, no decree or edict that the king issues can be changed. So the king gave the order, and they brought Daniel and threw him into the lion's den. The king said to Daniel, may your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you. A stone was brought and placed over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the rings of his nobles, so that Daniel's situation might not be changed. Then the king returned to his palace and spent the night without eating and without any entertainment being brought to him, and he could not sleep. At the first light of dawn, the king got up and hurried to the lion's den. When he came near the den, he called to Daniel in an anguished voice, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions? Daniel answered, may the king live forever. My God sent his angel, and he shut the mouths of the lions. They have not hurt me because I was found innocent in his sight, nor have I done any wrong before you, your majesty. The king was overjoyed and gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. And when Daniel was lifted from the den, no wound was found on him because he had trusted in his God. At the king's command, the men who had falsely accused Daniel were brought in and thrown into the lion's den, along with their wives and children. And before they reached the floor of the den, the lions overpowered them and crushed all of their bones. Then King Darius wrote to all the nations and peoples of every language in all the earth, may you prosper greatly. I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions. So Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. And so as this well-known story comes to a close, there's a lot we can learn from this. I mean, I've spent a good amount of time already on just like the lead up to this climax, just with the prayers of Daniel. And because there's so much that could be learned from a story like this, I want to just kind of poke out, why did I say that? I want to pull out three of them and focus particularly on one. And so the first point I want us to see is that God is a just God, and there will come a time when all will stand before the great judge. Now, I mean, this is a theme that's common in apocalyptic literature, and this is one of the two apocalyptic books in the whole collection of scripture. And this was the point, one of the main points of last week's sermon too, if you were here. In this story, we see God living up to this portrayal again, as the lion's den could be seen less as an execution and more as a trial by ordeal. And I say that, if you don't know what a trial by ordeal is, it's like a kind of a medieval thing where people would just like throw people into the water with a stone tied to their leg, and if they survived, then they were innocent, but if they died, they were guilty. It's pretty barbaric. But in a lot of ways, like this was a concept that was still used, I guess, in some ways in that time. And so it could be seen in this way, because when Daniel's thrown into this den and he emerges unscathed, he attributes his survival due to the fact that he was found innocent in God's eyes. And even Darius, when he throws him into the den, he has hopes that he might not die in this. It's not an execution in that way. Like he hopes that he will be found innocent in his God's eyes and then be saved because of it. And it's not like either that the lions just weren't hungry or that they were tired or something. Like, people actually do say that. Because when we then see the conspirators thrown in, they are crushed before they even reach the ground, because they are the guilty party. And I don't think it'd be too much of a stretch even to say that the book of Daniel as a whole is very much concerned with portraying God as a just judge, as one who will ultimately save his people and punish the evil nations. And if you remember at the start of this sermon series, I kind of talked about the importance of these guys' names. So like Daniel, Ananias, I'm forgetting the names. Azariah, Mishael, yeah, that's what it is. But the names were important, and Daniel's name means God is my judge. And so I think that is meant to be a big part of this book, is portraying God as this just judge. And the second point I want us to see is that all the comforts of the world pale in comparison with the comfort that comes from God's presence. And this, again, is a reiterated point that's already kind of been said in this series. If you remember from chapter 3, when Daniel preached on the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, he mentioned that even though these three men were tossed in the fire, God's presence was with them. And because his presence was with them, it was seen as a paradise. And now in this chapter, we see this contrast that takes place between Darius and Daniel. And Darius, he goes home where all the possible entertainment and food was at his fingertips for enjoyment, but instead he spent a sleepless night in torment, unable to eat any food and unable to be soothed by any entertainment. Whereas Daniel, he spent the night in a filthy pit with ravenous lions, and because God's presence had been sent to him in the form of an angel, Daniel had a much more restful and comfortable night than Darius. And the third point that I wanted us to really focus on, though, is that God has the power to overrule the evil intentions of men and women in order to bring about good. So the conspirators, they sought to incarcerate Daniel, but instead Daniel's proven innocent. But even more than that, God took this situation and used it to bring about glory and honor to his name throughout the entire kingdom. And the reason I want to hone in on this point is because it's a very common theme in Scripture. God often takes what appears to be horrible situations and turns them around to be used for good. And one prime example of this is seen in the life of Joseph, who, if just a quick recap of the story, he had a bunch of brothers, and they were jealous of him because he was the youngest brother, but he was receiving a lot of special treatment by his father. And so they want to kill him, really. And so they sell him off to some slaves. They sell him off as a slave to some people from Egypt. And he goes off to Egypt, And the story tracks his life as he slowly progresses up in rank in Egypt and eventually finds himself in this really influential point of power. And he hears about this famine that's about to come. And so he stores up all this grain. And then the famine hits. And people from all around are all of a sudden having to come to Egypt to receive this grain that he had so wisely stored up. And so Joseph's family ends up being among that group that comes, and he reveals that this is who he is now, and they're overjoyed that he's alive and sorry for doing what they did to him. But his response to all this is that he says in chapter 50 of Genesis, verse 20, he says, "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives." And the reason why this is important on a bigger, like if you zoom out even more, is that this family was the seed of Abraham. This was the descendants that were promised to then be fruitful and multiply and be a blessing to the nations. And so if this family was just wiped out by a famine, that whole promise would be gone. And so that this family's preservation in the midst of this is really important to the biblical story. And so we see God taking this situation where his brothers had wicked intentions of murdering him, and we see God using that to bring about salvation, really, for the people. And so even greater than these two stories of Daniel and Joseph, we see that Jesus' own life and death was an even greater fulfillment of this principle. And Peter understands this when he says, when he's preaching at Pentecost in Acts chapter 2, he says, "Men of Israel, listen to this. Jesus of Nazareth was a man accredited by God to you by miracles, wonders, and signs, which God did among you through him, as you yourselves know. This man was handed over to you by God's set purpose and foreknowledge, and you, with the help of wicked men, put him to death by nailing him on the cross. But God raised him from the dead, freeing him from the agony of death, because it was impossible for death to keep its hold on him. God took the evil intentions of the wicked men who nailed Jesus to the cross, and he raised Jesus from the dead, from the grave, therefore defeating death and opening this invitation for all who believe that Jesus is the Son of God to also no longer be held by the power of sin and death." And the story of Daniel and of Jesus in Christian history and a lot of Christian artwork even, they're often compared as very much similar. They're parallels in a lot of ways. And they see this because, you know, you look at the false charges that the jealous Persian administrators are trying to formulate against Daniel. They parallel that with the jealous religious leaders of Jesus' time trying to frame Jesus. They also notice that Daniel was arrested during this private prayer, whereas Jesus also was arrested in prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane. They also notice that Pilate and Darius, these two political leaders of the time, they both worked for the release of these men. They saw their innocence. But in the end, they both turn them over and give them to the demands of the crowd, turn them in to be executed. But the difference is that while Daniel emerges unscathed, Jesus dies. But this difference is exactly what makes Jesus' story so important and so powerful, that even though Jesus died, he emerged from the tomb and therefore defeated death. And the implications of this for us today are enormous. And so let me just suggest one that ties in with the book of Daniel. It is that this faith that Jesus has defeated the grave gives us the courage to risk everything. If Jesus has defeated death, we can walk by faith with in confidence that death will not have the final word for us either. This faith that Jesus has defeated the grave gives us the courage to risk everything, but we often act as if we're unwilling to risk anything. We get fearful of giving up control of our finances, of our homes, of our comfort. We instead want to live a risk-free life. But being a follower of Jesus does not promise, it doesn't promise us earthly security. And I realize that's kind of a scary thing for us. It's the reality that we see. And I mean, Ellen and I have been, it's not directly related to us being Christians, but I feel like in some ways it's still relatable that we just have a lot of unknowns in our life. We got a baby coming in a couple of weeks, I guess. It's kind of scary to say that, but it's like a month. I'll say a month. That's easier to handle. I still don't have a job when I'm done here, and we just moved to Abbotsford because we needed to have the more space, but now that limits my field of area where I can find work. But I'll tell you that even though there are so many unknowns with our future, I have felt increasingly more at ease when I pray and I give up my control of our finances, of our comfort, and of our home. Prayer has the effect of consistently reorienting our lives around Jesus so that we don't turn to worshiping money, status, jobs, or ourselves. And as we go out into this world where people don't know God and their lives are spent worshiping other things, the thing that turns heads to notice God is our willingness to risk everything to serve God. And so as we wrap up this story of Daniel and consider once again how to maintain our conviction in a culture of compromise, let us turn to prayer daily and remember Christ's work on the cross as the source of our courage, of our joy, of our strength, and of our perseverance. And so let's pray. God, I thank you that you continue to speak to us, that you use your word in ways that are relevant and applicable and hit us deeply sometimes. And I thank you that you are continually with us, even when we feel like you're far away. I pray that, like the exiles who may have felt that you were far and distant, I pray that you would draw near to those who do feel alone or abandoned. I pray that you would strengthen and encourage those who are currently facing persecution under the hand of oppressive leaders. And I thank you that for our relative peace in light of what takes place in this world. But I pray that even though we can live in peace in where we are, I pray that we wouldn't grow complacent in our faith. I pray that we would be bold in our witness to those around us. And that boldness would come from the promise that you have defeated sin and death. There is no one more worthy of you, God, and so we worship you.